Jackie DeShannon, put a little love in your heart, telling us all to, hey, chill, folks, take it down a couple of notches. We're talking with Tom Powell about his book, Edges of Science, the general topic of Bigfoot that leads to other places. I think when, you know, like with UFOs, you think about UFO photos and videos, as we know all too well from the internet every single day, that kind of evidence can be faked. And I guess when you talk about footprints or impressions made by Bigfoot, that could be faked as well. You know, I guess careful analysis in both instances could tell the difference between a fake and what is truly unexplainable. With Bigfoot, for me, what has always seemed compelling evidence is footprints or tracks in the middle of nowhere, not something put by the side of the road or by the side of a cabin where it seems designed to be discovered, but way up in the middle of nowhere, the top of some mountain ridge in the middle of a forest, and there's a little couple of tracks in the mud or something that no one could possibly ever plant with the expectation that somebody could find it. That suggests it's not something manufactured to me. There are some pretty good cases of track type evidence in this book that we'll talk about in just a moment, as well as interactions between Tom and his colleagues and friends and these other beings, whatever they are, wherever they're from. We're going to get into that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM in our final hour. Tom, talk to me about footprint track evidence. How good is it? In particular, you have a section in your book where you talk about what you call the London incident.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, we got wind of a bunch of tracks on a dry lake bed adjacent to what's called the Cottage Grove Reservoir. So we ran down there, and sure enough, we found over 100 prints in the mud, and all barefoot, of course, and in February, you know, in the middle of winter. So you wouldn't expect beachgoers to be out there barefoot. And, of course, the size of the tracks was impressively large. So, you know, it's pretty rare to find even a single track, but then to find 100 tracks is just beyond rare. But we were, being that it wasn't reported on the internet, you know, no one was claiming anything, no one was sending messages out on the internet. This was all done by word of mouth. And here again, you know, you got a dedicated local researcher, Toby Johnson, who puts himself out there, drives around Eugene, Oregon with footprints all over his car. So when this random fellow was walking his dog and found all these prints, he went by Toby's house and said, hey, guess what I found? You might be interested in this. So it's really interesting how the research game unfolds. That was one of the rarest finds you could ever hope to be a part of. And then subsequent to that, we got another track find a year or two later, and this time the person was sending it into the internet and sending it into the Bigfoot websites. So immediately there's a bit of a red flag there, and we get there, and there's a bunch of tracks, but there was something wasn't quite right about it. We did a little more investigating, and we were able to find, especially through the URL on the computer he was using, or the, you know, the signature numbers for that computer, found out that it was a Bigfoot gadfly. So you don't always win in this game. There is pranking going on. You certainly have to keep your skepticals on and be as suitably scientific as you can, but sometimes you get lucky. What's interesting about that Cottage Grove area is that there's some dairy farms down there, and here was a dairy farmer who was having a cow disappear every once in a while, and then somebody was in a isolated drainage, one drainage over from the Cottage Grove Reservoir, and they found this cow tethered to a rope made out of cedar bark in the middle of the woods. Here was this cow tied up, and we're assuming that maybe the cow was being, you know, kept there to produce milk. They finally found whose cow it was, and they brought it back to the farmer, and then they started putting things together, and the farmer observed that there are times when one of the cows in the morning has no milk to give, and that just shouldn't be. You know, that's almost an impossibility in dairy farming. And yet he was saying, you know, sometimes the cow. So all of a sudden we're able to put together this view that the Sasquatch are accessing the dairy cows for milk, and maybe even leading one of the cows off into the woods and keeping it there. It's just some crazy stuff goes on.
Yeah, well, you've got other examples in the book where people's, you know, freezer gets,
yep.
I guess it could be people doing it, but you got indications of folks who live out there in the forest or the edge of the forest who have ongoing interactions with
yeah.
something. There's gifting, there's exchanges.
Right.
Right?
And we just playing little games. You know, you're always rearranging sticks and leaves and then going back and seeing how it all changes. But then beyond just the sticks and leaves, you get other kinds of interesting animals disappear. I know these people in Dorina down there by near Eugene, and they were having their chickens would disappear. Well, finally, this one chicken was their favorite one disappeared, so she actually went outside and said, bring that one back. Well, then the next night, they were sitting around the campfire, and the chicken walked right into the campfire circle. They had a lead rope disappear from their barn, and so she felt it was them, and so she once again said, we need that rope back. And the next morning there was the rope neatly coiled at the foot of the barn door. So some funny things are going on.
That was a case with a cat, right? The remains of a cat.
Oh, well, that happened to me, and boy, that was a really strange one, because here was I found part of the cat in my yard, and the collar was there, and I was able to, the collar had the phone number, and I was able to call the people up, and it turned out that they were several miles away, and on the other side of the river, they had no idea how the cat got there, and yet there it was in my yard, and then the rest of the cat was found in a neighbor's yard. So we were able to the cat wasn't eaten, but the cat certainly was, dead and dismembered. But there were all the pieces, and sometimes you just don't know what to think. I hate to lay all that stuff at the Sasquatch doorstep, but we were able to rule out owls and coyotes and mountain lions for various reasons, which, you know, gets kind of lengthy.
You had a story about your laptop. That's kind of
weird.
Oh,
boy. It disappeared at Glacier National Park, and then it showed up 100 miles away in this guy's pickup truck in Whitefish, Montana. Just crazy stuff for it. And we're able to backtrace that he had been near the area where the computer disappeared, and he was a security guard, and he refilled the money in bank machines around that area of Montana. So he traveled around a lot. He found it in his truck. All of the valuables were still in the computer case. Nothing was disturbed, but somehow the computer moved 100 miles away, or maybe it was put in his truck and he drove it. Just a crazy story. We don't always know that it's Sasquatch. Maybe it is one of these other paranormal entities. But what you find is when you put yourself out there as a paranormal researcher, this crazy stuff, these synchronicities are happening to you that seem to indicate that as you're studying them, they're studying you. And
well,
that's a thought that goes back even to John Keel, one of the original, paranormal researchers. And he found when he was doing the Mothman stuff that sure enough, the more he tried to investigate and understand what was going on with all of this paranormal stuff around Point Pleasant, West Virginia, the more that they were actually keying in on him. So it's a weird feeling when you all of a sudden realize that, oh, my God, they know who I am. They know where I live. I can't undo that.
Well, there are instances in the book, and you've participated in them, where people leave stuff out for them. You put it in a spot, you leave it for them.
Right. And again, that's sort of an eye roller for some people, because we go, look, it's changed, it's different. And they go, well, that's not proof of anything. And I'd be the first to agree. It's a game we play, but once again, if the context of the situation is such that you know that it isn't people doing it, then you're sort of left. You're forced to come up with some other explanations that suddenly get somewhat paranormal.
So there are cases, instances in your book where you describe an interaction, a communication of sorts, where they whoever they are, they communicate and give instructions. There's a case where you talk about somebody being told to put down a gun.
Well, the best one was these fellows I know, Ron Lewis and his buddy there in Ohio, and they felt they had found a Sasquatch grave. And of course, this speaks to one of the big questions: how come there's no bones? Why don't we find, we don't leave our human brethren face down in the ditch when they die. We dispose of their remains appropriately, and we think that these creatures do the same thing. So darned if he didn't feel like he had a Sasquatch grave, and in an act of tremendous hubris, they decided they were going to exhume the grave. Well, they got pretty far into it, and then they ran out of time, and they went home, and with the plan of returning the next day to finish the job. They were going to find the bones. They were going to be famous. Both of the gentlemen in different houses had an apparition appear to them in their bedroom, 8 feet tall and scraping up against the ceiling and big and hairy, and said, "Put my grave back." And it scared them so badly that they each went to the phone in the middle of the night, called each other, and said, "Did you just have what I?" Yeah. And they went back. They put that grave back. When I was in Ohio not too long ago, Ron showed me the grave. He said, "Don't you ever touch this grave. Please don't tell anybody it's here." But this is the story I have. So oddly, it may suggest that even when they're deceased, they still maintain some degree of awareness and power.
You have a story in the book about it. I'm trying to remember where it is exactly in the chapter, but a group of people who are out there and are told to sit down in sort of a
Yeah, that was part of the
semi-muddy.
London tracks. Toby and those of us who found they did a night investigation after we did all the casting, and sure enough, right, they went up into this area where they felt things were emanating from, where sightings had happened in the past. John Bull sort of led them in that direction, and boy, they had a whole bunch of stuff. It was somebody starts feeling really ill. The biggest, baddest one of the group all of a sudden has to turn around and leave for reasons that he himself couldn't understand. The rest of them are walking along, and all of a sudden their extremities are going numb. Then so various things like this are starting to happen, and they just suddenly realize we're being worked here. That something out there is messing with us. It all became very overwhelming for them, and then they eventually sat down in the rain and tried to, let the creatures, or see if the creatures wouldn't approach him, which they did not. They had a whole host of crazy things happening to them in the middle of the night, until they finally just decided, "We got to get out of here while we're still inside our skin." But that was Toby, and that was part of the whole London track chapter.
So what is the Let's talk about the connection to a broader reality or a broader understanding of reality. Bigfoot, Sasquatch, if it's beings, telepathic, that's strange enough by itself. And then you get it associated with other paranormal, again, air quotes around it. There are stories about UFO activity, other kinds of beings around them. What do you make of that?
I think that they're two sides of the same coin. For one thing, when we experiment with this communication, one of the questions that was tendered by Steve Fredericks is, where are you guys from? Are you from space? Are you space beings?" And they said, "No, we're from here. You're the space beings." It's this Michael Tellinger thing that we were genetically spliced and so on. But oddly enough, we get that sort of answer back. And then there's the whole underground connection. I'm convinced that the Sasquatch emanate from underground hideouts, and the ET people say similar things. So you start to go, "Wait a minute, I keep hearing the same things over. Maybe there's a connection." So I think we're exploring that right now and getting some really interesting things that seem to, I think, support the idea that these different entities, the ETs and the Sasquatch, are emanating from underground hideouts, citadels, you know, hiding places, maybe even very large ones. That's what the Indians say. So once again, you get a source of information from the Indians. It's coming from underground. Well, I guess my logical side says that if all of these entities are emanating from underground, they must know each other, because there can't be tremendous amounts of space down there. Maybe there is. There must be some overlap. So, you know, I'm really sort of pursuing that now and finding some really interesting things that also speak to that. The Mima Mounds is a mystery that I think factors in, and I became convinced of that when I found that, darned if that southeast Oklahoma area doesn't have the mounds, and all of the places where the Sasquatch activity emanates from seems to also have these mounds, and the mounds to me suggest something having to do with underground excavations.
And again, back to the Native American part of it, I mean, some of the work that we had done about that Utah ranch, the stories, the creation stories that are told, the Navajo and the Hopi, right, they all seem to have come out of the ground. That's part of their story.
They appeared on the surface naked one day, and and then the Anasazi, same thing. In fact, some people also interpret the Anasazi mystery as not only did they come from underground, but that's where they also went, because the Anasazi, of course, disappeared rather suddenly. All at once, and they left the table set in their kivas and their dwellings and just went somewhere. So it may be that this whole portal thing sort of factors in, but one thing that I was given to understand is that the portals in most cases actually are underground. So maybe, you know, that sort of helps address that question too. And you know, Politis, I think, has a pretty compelling set of reasons to suppose that some of these disappearing people cases may have to do with some sort of portal business. And scientifically, it's a real frontier, but there is some physics behind it. And so I did a chapter on what's with this portal thing. And darned if I wasn't getting a lot of information, again, from Indians about these little shimmering spots that you sometimes run into in the woods. And I think the consensus is, do not mess with these things. It may have something to do with disappearances and so on. So not every little paranormal mystery is, I think, a scab that we necessarily want to pick.
Well, you wonder how much of the description is metaphorical. We, you know, we came from underground.
Yeah.
We came from another world. Maybe it's a dimensional thing. Maybe the shimmering is a way to move back and forth. And when these creatures say they're from here, they're not from outer space. They're from here, but here is not here.
Right. And you know, dimensionality, this whole idea, well, you know, many people are of the view that Sasquatch is somehow an interdimensional being because they see it dissolve away in some sort of disappearing act. And I don't laugh at that stuff, but it's hard to factor it in and understand it. But then I find that the UFO people describe the same thing. And so all of a sudden you go, whoa, they're all using the same playbook. They must know each other. There must be some overlap in these phenomena. And I think underground ends up being, you know, relevant. Now, I know there are these hollow earthers, and I know that you know, the earth is very hot inside. I don't necessarily think the planet is hot, but you could have underground hideouts underneath mountains that put you no closer to the center of the earth than we are standing here at sea level. So there are ample places to be installed underground and still not be, you know,
in magma.
Right.
Right. We're talking with Tom Powell about his book, Edges of Science. Fun stuff here. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls. A lot of folks on the line with questions and comments. Stick around. Leon Russell, by the way, the late Leon Russell, takes us into the break. Always like this song by William Devon. It's just seems like a tune you'd play when you're cruising around in your car with the top down, or maybe hanging out on the beach or by the pool, Or maybe it's a song for going hunting Bigfoot up in the woods, but it definitely tells you to take it down a notch. Into the break, we had a song from Leon Russell, Tightrope. What an amazing and talented character he was, and such a tragic year it's been for music. I guess we're into that demographic where a lot of the greats of classic rock and blues are getting up there in years, and Prince and David Bowie and Glenn Frey. What a year it was for losses. I guess it's probably not going to get any much better, but at least we can still listen to the greats like Leon Russell on recordings. And in a moment, we're going to pick up the conversation with Tom Powell about his book, Edges of Science. Go to the phones. A lot of you folks have comments and stories about Bigfoot encounters of your own. We're going to hear them in just a moment. Our final segment with Tom Powell about his book, Edges of Science, Bigfoot and Other Topics. We're going to go to the phones west of the Rockies, Mike in Aberdeen, Washington. Hi, Mike.
Hello there. How are you this evening?
All right. What's on your mind?
Good. You know, in about 1972 or 73, myself, a friend, and my father were hunting up east of Marcola, Oregon. And I heard your guest, he's from Oregon. And we were up Shotgun Creek Road, probably 8 or 9 miles back up. And in the afternoon, we started back down a logging road there, dirt road. And in front of us, walking down the center of this, was an animal, maybe 22 or 24 inches tall. And it was like dark brown with reddish cast hair. And it was just walking. And I was just coasting behind it. And we were saying, what is that? And like, between the three of us, my friend, he was from Pennsylvania. My father, he was from like Missouri, Illinois, Arkansas, Kansas. And myself, the West Coast. And we've all been a lot of places. But we about had the whole country covered. And we said, what is this animal? And it was walking along. It was strutting with its, head, neck, shoulders, and chest. It was strutting. And then all of a sudden it stopped and it turned its head a little to the left, where it could pick me up in its peripheral vision, and it straightened its head back forward and stood there about 5 seconds. And then it darted for the brush to its left and then jumped back in the middle of the road and ran maybe 15 feet and then dove off into the brush. But we drove back to Portland, where we were living at, maybe 130 miles. All the way back, we discussed what was this? What was that animal? It was not a bear, it was not a dog, it was not a badger, it was not, to this day, no idea what this was.
It was so, 2 feet tall?
Maybe just 2 feet tall. It was on all fours walking, though.
Well, the Indians say, you white people look for the big ones all the time, to Bigfoot researcher guys like me, and they say, but, there's little ones, too, and they're actually a lot easier to see, but you're busy looking for the big ones. Keep your eyes open for the little ones. You'll see them, too. There's two different kinds. And then other people say, if you just look up more, that you'll find that the little ones especially are arboreal. They're up above. They're in the trees. So I guess there is some precedent for what you're saying. You're not crazy. We're kind of built around this Sasquatch idea, 8 feet tall. But there is a fair amount of lore saying that there's little ones, too. But then there may be other entities as well, and I think Politis runs into these things when he looks into the disappearing things. It probably goes beyond one set of beings, the Sasquatch, and so you were lucky enough to see one of the other ones.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for sharing. The Utes have their own stories about little people like that, little tiny versions of that. East of the Rockies, Skip in Vermont. Hi, Skip.
Listen, regarding the apples, if in fact they've you still there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. If these apples make it past the first frost, then they start fermenting, and there's nothing any worse than an ugly drunk. That's what happens.
I've seen drunk birds. You're right. That the berries ferment on the vines around me, and the birds get tipsy from eating the fermented berries.
Yeah, same thing with the apples. You get a big animal, And he eats 4, 5, 6 large apples. He starts fermenting further in his stomach, and he's gone. I thought I'd share that with you.
I just hope they're overage, you know.
Thanks. Appreciate the call. We got a first-time caller, John, in Miami. Hi, John. You're on with Tom Powell.
Okay. A lot of the things I've heard tonight sound familiar to me, but back in February, I saw one of these. Looks like a large monkey, about 7 feet tall or so. And I was able to call the zoo and give a description to them on the tape. And I tried to get the Department of Natural Resources for the state to warn them that this thing was running around. And it was around for about a couple of hours that night. And
where were you? Where were you when this happened?
This was in the near the downtown area, believe it or not, but it's kind of a like a wilderness area near the river.
In Florida there.
In Florida, yeah, in Miami. And
They call them the skunk apes down by you, right?
Well, I didn't smell anything. I eventually got within 20 feet of the thing and tried to get a picture. And like you said, my camera failed. It wouldn't work. I couldn't get a picture. Couldn't get it with my with the telephone either. And the strangest thing of the entire night, I don't even like to tell this to people because it sounds like you're crazy. But the end of the night, that thing was joined by an owl. An owl showed up that had looked like the face of a man on it. And I've had nightmares about that since. I just couldn't believe I saw something that way, but I did. Wish I could have gotten that on film. And they both, more or less, like you said, went toward the ground, and they both just dissolved. They just both evaporated. And I just couldn't believe that I saw that. I had 2 cups of coffee at the beginning of the night, so I know I was well aware of what was going on.
Well, it's a weird world that we're in, and sometimes I think someone leaves the portal door open and all the stuff comes streaming through into our world, and then I think they maybe return where they came from, and then we're sort of back in control of our world. So I think it does seem that there are different kinds of entities that are sometimes present in our world, and the rest of the time they're not. And where they go when they're not here, anybody's guess. So, boy, it's a weird one. But all I can say is about the appearance of the face. It's very misleading. You know, we assume that because they look like a monkey face that they must be monkeys, and I think that's probably the biggest mistake that a lot of people make when we confer upon them, ape status, is that we're judging them by their appearances, and I think that's probably a mistake.
John, thanks for the call, and thanks for sharing that story. Yeah, I mean, if they look different at different times, they look different to different people, you have to wonder what they really do look like, if they can change their appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
We're going to go to the wild card one line, Mark in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. How are you? And thank you for taking my telephone call.
Sure thing.
Yes, your guest has been very interesting, and so I have a question. Have you seen the Patterson-Gimlin film? Because
yeah.
I've seen that, and it's very convincing.
Yeah, I was just hanging out with Bob Gimlin last night.
I believe it's a real
event. It is real. It is as genuine as can be. You're not going to convince everyone, but no, in 1967, when it was filmed, no one had the ability to do that kind of costuming. And you know what's also interesting is that nothing much has come out of that area ever since. So you know, just to reference a point I made before, they don't like to be filmed and photographed. It's considered a screw up, and I think that the creature that was filmed successfully by Roger Patterson as Bob sat there on his horse screwed up, and she knew it, and that. As a result, that nothing has come out of that area ever since. They got smarter. They don't make the same mistake twice. But we sure got lucky. That is the best piece of film that it is and may ever be.
Mark, thanks for bringing that up. Tom, there's been such a concerted effort to discredit that, to debunk that film. Is it organized?
Or yeah, sure. I mean, you know, again, if the Sasquatch relate to the ET phenomenon, then of course there's a good reason why maybe we want to keep this stuff swept under the rug. So the question in a lot of people's mind is why, if it's just an ape, why is the government or whoever trying to keep us in the dark? And I think the answer is because it's not an ape. And I think the phenomenon either leads us to other phenomena or is pretty much another side of the same coin. So I think that to me is a plausible reason why there's a bit of a takedown. Not that it's working, mind you. You know, the Sasquatch thing is bigger than ever, but they certainly tried to slow the research effort by discrediting it and saying it's phony when it obviously is not.
You know, we had the call from the guy in Miami saying that he saw something. Are there cases that of urban Bigfoot?
Well, yeah, I think sometimes security cameras get these weird things, and then they're ghostly apparitions, but sometimes they have, again, sort of a primate look to them. I'm of the view that they can put themselves into our surroundings and not be seen. I think they understand our civilization and our culture and our world as well as we do. They can come and go from our world pretty easily.
We got a call from Jared. I think he's in Utah, who's had an experience, wants to share it with us. Welcome to the program. You're on with Tom Powell.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. This happened to me about 20 years ago when I was living up in Idaho. A bunch of friends and I went up to an old ski run outside of town and decided to play flashlight tag. And we had decided the boundaries were where it ended down at the bottom, where it went into the bowl, up to where the two lanes crossed. That's as high as you could go. And we all took off, and most of the kids went down into the middle, into the trees, and then me and two other friends went up to the top where we said, you know, you can't go any further than this. And we were up there kind of making noises, doing the Budweiser frogs. And then we saw the kid that had been chosen to come find everybody. He started running up through the middle. And the other two guys I was with, they went down the left one, and I went down the right one by myself. And I got about halfway down because I saw the kid coming back towards me, so I kind of stopped. And for some reason, I turned and I looked back up to where we were sitting doing the Budweiser frogs. And there was something standing there, and I kind of just brushed it off, and then I kept going, and I got down to the bottom of the hill, and I turned and looked, and it was standing where I had just been standing, and then I started back towards where everybody was at. I got about halfway there, and I turned around, and it was standing right where I had just been standing when I was looking up the hill. And then all the kids started coming over looking for me, and I saw it just take off running, and it went back up into the woods. And I just kind of thought that was kind of curious. I didn't feel scared or anything. It was just kind of like, you know, I don't know if I was kind of curious, and I just kind of wanted to find out what was going on. Or
yeah, it was definitely doing it for your benefit, would be my view. In other words, you know, on the one hand, you were very lucky. You know, you got a pretty good view of something that normally isn't going to let us see it. But out in those situations, you know, at night and it's where it's in control of the situation, it was as interested in what you guys were doing with those flashlights as you might have been curious about it. So it was just checking you guys out. You got lucky.
Yeah, if you see it, then you're suggesting, Tom, if you see one, it's because they want you to be able to see
it. In general, screw-ups do happen, especially with the young, because the young don't have the same, you know, abilities to evade and throw us off. They have to learn that. So the young are more vulnerable to screw-ups, and so when in these habituation sites, most of what they see is the young ones.
As we get close to the end of the program, maybe some big issue kind of stuff. I wonder if this, as a science teacher, as investigator, researcher, is this a solvable mystery? You know, because maybe as with the UFO ET mystery and some other ones, mm-hmm. Maybe it's about the journey, the right. quest to figure it out, the pushing the boundaries of what you think reality is. Maybe it's always going to be tantalizingly out of reach.
Absolutely. But also the answers also go back much further than we realize, you know, in the Bible and even like Sumerian cuneiform texts talk about some of these paranormal entities. So the answers are there all over the place, and they've been questions in throughout human history. It's only recently that we're trying to hammer them into a scientific sort of mold, trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, maybe. But I think greater degrees of understanding are coming our way right now. But it is slow, and I think it really does actually all end up pertaining to our place in the galaxy, that we're in a galaxy that's absolutely alive with creatures of various descriptions, and they're not all nice.
There's one, I don't think we're going to have time to take this call from Mike in West Palm Beach, but he wanted to know if someone captures a Bigfoot, what it would be worth, and are there laws against it?
A big can of worms, you know, I guess good luck capturing it. It's got tricks up its sleeve that are going to enable it to evade you. Certainly it would be an incredibly important scientific specimen, and I think they already have been acquired, and sorry to go there, but I think again it's one of those cover-up deals where for reasons that I'm not quite sure of, the information, you know, the genetic material is in the hands of someone somewhere, but it's just not out there for our inspection.
Well, I mean, you've shared with us your journey, starting looking for a physical being and how your views have changed. It's sort of like the UFO field. It's very similar.
Right.
There are folks who look at this as nuts and bolts craft from other planets. But the longer you stay in the field, though, it tends to be people's views change, and it's a much broader understanding of reality. And, you know, we don't have many solid answers, but the journey sure is fun.
And if you're trying to figure it out and you're having trouble, I would say widen the search. Bring in some of these other paranormal areas or other scientific areas. You just have to sort of broaden the search, and all of a sudden it all starts to fall together. That's the way it works for me, and that's sort of the general theme of Edges of Science, is that
right.
A whole bunch of things that seem separate and unrelated are probably similar keys to the same lock.
I'm with you on that. Tom Powell, thanks for joining us. It was really interesting. I hope people will check out the book. It's called Edges of Science, and let me know what else you're working on, and you can come back and join me the next time.
If they want a signed one, they're going to have to deal with me, so they're going to have to, they can find me on the web. Just Google
right.
Tom Powell, THOM, and it'll come up, but otherwise it's available on Amazon. I really appreciate you giving me the time on your show, George, and I want to thank you.
Absolutely. We've got the link on our website as well. Thanks to my colleagues there at Coast, Nathan Staten, Donna Walker, Dan Galani, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, and producer Chris Boros. George Norrie is back tomorrow night to talk about JFK with Richard Belzer. I'll be back next Sunday night. I hope you all have a wonderful Thanksgiving. If you're traveling, be safe out there. It's crazy. Good night.